KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump this week said that solving the opioid crisis is an absolute priority, but rejected the advice of his Commission on Drug Addiction, which asked that the crisis be declared a national emergency. We'll talk about what Trump's decision means for efforts to combat the epidemic in California, where hospitals treat an opioid overdose from heroin or prescription painkillers once every 45 minutes. It's coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. In many of California's rural, low-income counties, the opioid epidemic is hitting particularly hard. This week, President Trump said a stepped-up law enforcement response is needed to deal with the national problem, though he did not declare a state of emergency, as his expert commission on the issue requested. And in this opening forum hour, we want to talk about the opioid crisis in California and what can be done to combat it. And just to give you a little perspective on how serious this is, the numbers continue to escalate and get staggering. Overdoses by opioids or heroin now, in terms of deaths, have surpassed gun homicides and car crashes combined and are worse than HIV/AIDS at its peak in the early 2000s. So this is a serious and profound problem, and we have a number of people who are here to talk about it. And, of course, we do want to hear from you in the course of this hour. Let me first welcome Keith Humphreys, who's professor of psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine, joins us. Keith Humphreys, welcome back to the Forum.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again, Michael.
And Jennifer Kent is with us as well. She directs the California Department of Healthcare Services. She's in the state capital of Sacramento. Welcome, Jennifer Kent.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And let me also welcome Kelly Pfeiffer, who is here with us in studio. And she's an MD and directs the high-value care team with the California Healthcare Foundation. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you all with us. And Keith Humphreys, let me begin with you just to get some national perspective, because the president did set up this commission under Chris Christie. They're talking about September 11th every 3 weeks, just in terms of how serious the problem is and the overdoses. But why it's not being declared a national emergency is the president doesn't want to at this point declare it a national emergency, even though it was recommended by the commission. So maybe we can get a general picture from you about what the commission recommended and why it's not a national emergency.
So what the commission said is if you declare this an emergency, it allows states to access the same fund that is normally used for hurricanes and tornadoes. You know, when a president says this is a disaster area, you can get these relief funds. And they wanted that to be applied to the opioid epidemic. And states could use that money, you know, for treatment, for naloxone, which is the rescue drug for overdoses, and so on. And the president said he didn't want to do that. And that does not surprise, because through the year, you know, he has been advocating repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which gives a lot of people access to addiction treatment. His budgets have cut services for addiction treatment. So it was consistent with his stance, which is he's not interested in the public health part very much. He's only interested in the law enforcement side of this.
Well, let me bring Jennifer Kent into this and see if we can focus somewhat on California with you, Jennifer Kent. It's a different situation here. I mean, we're not as dependent on federal assistance here, although an emergency declaration might have helped, or would it have helped? What can you tell us?
Well, I would certainly say that, you know, from a enhancement of public awareness, emergency declarations help draw people's attention that may not otherwise be paying attention. But, you know, the Department of Healthcare Services oversees the state Medicaid program, so we have approximately 14 million beneficiaries. Today, we have a budget of over $100 billion, about $60 billion of which are federal funds. We also administer block grants for substance abuse prevention and treatment in the state of California. We license residential treatment facilities and assisted outpatient drug treatment programs. And so federal funds are very important to us, but we have a variety of federal funds that are flowing to California through several initiatives that we're working on now. And so a state of emergency wouldn't necessarily change the work that has been underway at our department for a number of years.
Well, the numbers in California, let me see if I can get a bead on this from you, are lower. But in Northern California, and this is odd in many ways, they tend to be much higher, particularly up in the rural counties, Lake and Plumas, Lassen, Humboldt, those areas. Do we have any idea why that is?
I'm not a, you know, I would certainly defer to Mr. Humphreys, too, from an academic perspective. But, you know, my own personal kind of recognition is that a lot of the rural counties in California both have lower population in general compared to larger either Bay Area or Southern California counties. So any kind of public health occurrence is going to have a higher percentage of the population involved. So that's one explanation in my mind. And then a lot of these high northern counties in many ways reflect some of the same circumstances that other states are seeing. So Ohio, New Hampshire, rural counties with depressed economic circumstances, a lack of availability in terms of providers and access to certain kinds of services. And so in some ways, Northern California more closely reflects what is happening in other parts of the nation.
But Keith Humphreys, you wrote a piece about how the epidemic started on a rural level and now has become not only national, but probably widespread throughout the state of California. I mean, the hospitals, the emergency rooms are being flooded by millennials because of heroin, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah. So the epidemic originally was in places like where I'm from, Appalachia and rural areas. But the latest data for the national survey data from 2015 shows that it's spreading now into the suburbs and the cities. So the likelihood that somebody is prescribed a prescription opioid is about the same in a rural area as an urban area. The likelihood that they take it and misuse it in some way different than what they're supposed to do with it is about the same. It's just that rural areas suffer more for the reasons that were just said. You know, just think of, you know, the classic situation. If you have an overdose in a city versus out in the country, how far away are you from a hospital? How likely are you to be able to get naloxone? You know, is there an ambulance service? There may not be. So the same risk situation has a much higher mortality risk for someone in, you know, a rural county than someone living in San Francisco.
Well, let me bring Dr. Kelly Pfeiffer into this. Again, she directs the high-value care team with the California Healthcare Foundation. Epidemic numbers are getting higher in the rural areas. Rates of overdose are worse there than West Virginia and Kentucky. I mean, can you give us some insight into why?
Well, I think I would agree with what's been said already. It started out as a rural epidemic. I think there's some relation to practice patterns. When you are a physician and you go practice in a rural area, you tend to be unaffiliated, much more independent. And I think all of us who have practiced in the last 20 years were heavily influenced by false pharmaceutical advertising, which told us, don't worry, opioids are safe, you can prescribe them at high doses. And so we found when we were practicing, like I was, in a rural area with a lot of poverty, a lot of unemployment, a lot of people doing manual labor who then injured their back and presented in pain, we found ourselves using more and more opioids to try and solve that patient's problem right in front of us.
The doctors have been a lot of the problem.
Yeah,
I mean, this
absolutely
has been characteristic of a lot of the criticism. We'll get into the nature of that. But I wanted to actually explore with you more, because you're running opioid programs in local communities. You're actually talking to medical practitioners and so forth. What are you doing? And I mean, in terms of setting up these programs and just how effective are they?
Well, it's very clear that medications for addiction are phenomenally effective. And we saw France drop their death rates by 80% by making buprenorphine widely available. So buprenorphine is a medication that stabilizes the brain, reduces cravings, and helps people with addiction participate in society. So most of our work, and in fact a really great partnership with Department of Health Care Services, is to get these treatments into the hands of rural providers, many of whom, like myself, were not trained in addiction, never saw it as part of our job, and now we're stepping up and it's becoming part of our job because there's no one else there. And we're seeing such creativity, like in Modoc County, this tiny little county, we've got a family doc who started to prescribe in jails and for pregnant women because, as she said, there's no one else here. I'm the game in town, and it's my job to help out.
But you know, you see, for example, rates of take airline pilots who have these kinds of addictions. And when they go in an emergency room and then they have follow-up, there are resources. And the problem is dealt with and ameliorated to a great extent. In underprivileged and low-income areas, it becomes harder and harder to deal with, doesn't it?
Absolutely. When we put up a map of California, the entire North had no opioid treatment programs, and the entire North is where we're seeing these high death rates. So healthcare services got a big federal grant that's looking at putting what we're calling hubs and spokes. Hubs are specialty treatment programs, and spokes are primary care practices or mental health practices or jails or EDs. And the idea is to create a system of care so no matter where you land, if it's an emergency department, a mental health clinic, a primary care clinic, you can get the help you need. And but you're right, professionals have always had resources to treatment, where people with lower income and fewer resources, it's been a big barrier.
And again, Kelly Pfeiffer directs the High Value Care Team with the California Healthcare Foundation. And Keith Humphreys is professor of psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine. I mentioned an article that you did, Keith, on the epidemic starting rural and going national. I ought to mention another article, which I thought was very good, about how this epidemic has made the fight against HIV more difficult because increasing shared infected syringes and the like. But what about declaring this a state of emergency here in California? Would it help? And how much would it help?
We need that federal money more, or we need the money that comes through Medicaid, as was described. So the devastating thing would have been repealing the ACA and repealing the Medicaid. The actual money in the fund is about $1 billion at the moment, spread over the whole country. That's not going to make a really big difference. The other part of an emergency declaration is it gives states more flexibility in how they spend funding. So there's restrictions in what Medicaid can pay for. Medicaid can't pay for residential treatment in a facility that has more than 16 beds. And in a state of emergency, you can say, we're going to waive that because we have such a crisis, we want to dramatically increase access. You could also former presidential candidate Jeb Bush had an op-ed. I thought he raised a good point. The government can't currently negotiate drug prices. Well, in an emergency, you could waive that rule and have them negotiate down the price of naloxone, the overdose rescue drug, which has soared. So those kinds of powers could be useful if the federal government was interested in a public health response, which I hope they will get interested in. But at the moment, they don't seem to be.
Well, let's talk about what else can be done. I mean, but take this from the vantage point of the administration seemingly emphasizing law enforcement. I mean, to what extent do you see, Keith Humphreys, that being maybe the wrong road to go here?
I mean, I think we did that, you know, in the 1980s. And the only thing I miss about the 1980s is having hair. You know, it put a lot of people in prison, including a lot of low-level people. And yes, they did, you know, they did petty theft. They did things that were annoying and so on. But then we paid a huge sum of money to keep them in jail. And then they come out, a lot of them would overdose. So most of the country, again, outside Washington, has moved away from that. And not just blue states. I mean, Texas is closing prisons. South Carolina, South Dakota. They figured out that it's better to invest in addiction and mental health services for a lot of the people who are swept up in the criminal justice system and try to restore them as opposed to lock them away for 5, 10, 20 years. And the other part of this is the reality of the life of an addicted person is they're not thinking 5, 10, 20 years ahead. They're usually thinking about how they're going to get their heroin today. So when a legislator says, you know, we're going to up this penalty instead of 10 years, it's going to be 20 years, that's meaningless to them. It doesn't deter. It doesn't do what people think it's going to do in terms of deterring drug use.
Jennifer Kent, let me go back to you again. Jennifer Kent directs the California Department of Health Services. She's with us from Sacramento this morning. There's been some concern about, well, we've already expressed it, about doctors overprescribing, and there are some states that are seeing to it that prescription levels are reduced and required or mandatory in terms of those reductions. But California is lacking in its prescription monitoring programs. It's behind other states, isn't it?
Well, I can't necessarily speak to the database that's run through the State Department of Justice, which is called the CURES database for prescribing patterns. But, you know, we have about 80% of our Medicaid population in managed care. The remaining 20% is in our fee-for-service delivery system. And, you know, what we have really focused on over the last several years, especially since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, is looking at delivery system reform in terms of how are we managing patients, how are we treating their conditions, and what level and what type of treatment setting are those individuals seeking care. And one of the really exciting things that kind of came about in 2013, 2014 was the creation and the approval of a waiver amendment for us in California to create an organized delivery system for the substance use disorder treatment. And so just as Mr. Humphreys just mentioned, that Medicaid traditionally does not support paying for residential treatment services. Our waiver that was the first in the nation that was approved by the federal government allows for us to offer residential services in counties that we are currently working with to provide a full spectrum of substance use disorder services. I think that, you know, the other thing that we've been working with our health plans on, and certainly Dr. Pfeiffer has been a part of this as well, we have regular meetings with our chief medical officers of our 22 contracting Medicaid managed care plans. And we have plans that have specifically focused on prescribing patterns for their network physicians. And one of those plans, Partnership Health Plan, it's a county organized health system based out of Vallejo, and our they have a lot of Northern California counties, and they saw in their own plan patients that were struggling with addiction issues. And so they have very specifically and closely worked with their providers to make sure that prescriptions were both appropriate and carefully monitored. And so there's a variety of mechanisms that we use in the state to both make sure that prescriptions are provided appropriately, but also, you know, making sure on the back end, if someone does have an addiction problem, that we are trying to triage that and treat it.
Do you have a position on safe injection sites or drug checking services, those kinds of things?
You know, I try to stay in my own swim lane, so I don't. From my department's perspective, you know, we pay for, authorize, and, you know, try to be innovative and efficient in the services that we deliver, but we don't necessarily have a position in that area.
Let me go back to Kelly Pfeiffer. Would you like to weigh in on, again, prescription monitoring and programs that we are lagging here in California, aren't we?
Well, I am actually not sure that's true, because our CURES program, which is our prescription drug monitoring database, was held out at a national conference as a real model, because it's an example of how we can't do things the way we've always done with Department of Justice just focusing on law enforcement and public health, just on public health. The leader of the CURES database in the Department of Justice reached out to public health and said, I want this system to be a way to save lives. And so he redesigned the CURES program. So as a doctor, when I look it up, I get an alert immediately with all of my patients who hit any of five risk categories. And he specifically released a lot of the data to the public health department. So now we have this very innovative dashboard where you can go on and see your own county and your own zip code, where you stack up with overdose deaths, ED visits, and prescriptions, both buprenorphine prescriptions for addiction and the opioid prescriptions. So I've been real proud of our state in terms of how each of these state departments, normally working in isolation, has pulled together to fight the epidemic.
And your thoughts about emphasis on tough law enforcement? I mean, we have Jeff Sessions talking about, again, longer sentences, seizing and taking away property of people who are charged with drug crimes, that sort of thing.
Well, we've been doing that for three decades, and it's failed. And all we've got as a result is a very expensive prison system, which has disenfranchised a huge population. So we've criminalized addiction, which has failed, and all of the evidence is pointing to addiction as a chronic disease. And if we were to switch gears, like I had mentioned France did, and see and actually focus on treating addiction instead of putting people in jail for it, that's the only way we'll drop the death rate.
And let me mention prevention here, too, because I think that's a very important part of the piece, don't you?
Absolutely. And one of the most inspiring things for me is to look at the AIDS epidemic. It was another epidemic where we stigmatized the people who had it, blamed them for their disease, ostracized them, kept them from care. And the minute that we had an effective drug treatment and an effective prevention strategy, death rates plummeted. And so now we hardly see anyone dying of HIV. And that's where we need to go with this epidemic as well.
There's a different kind of stigma, though. Keith Humphreys, you know, you think about the opioid crisis, it seems to be more sympathy than there was with the crack cocaine epidemic. And that may be because of race?
I think that's definitely in the soup. You know, and you could contrast it to the methamphetamine epidemic, and that epidemics among poor people, particularly poor poor people of color have attracted less sympathy historically than when the drug problem has risen up into the white middle class and more connected people, people who can tell their stories in compelling fashion, people who the media sympathizes with and so on. The other thing is that this has not been the only good thing about this epidemic. It hasn't been violent, which the crack cocaine epidemic was. And violence scares everybody and often leads people to be unsympathetic and to lash out in return. So that's about the only good thing I could say about it. So that's another reason I think we've been a little more compassionate this time.
Well, you were talking about going back to the 80s and your hair notwithstanding here. No, I'm struck by the fact that President Trump said, well, you know, what we really need to do, the best way to do or to deal with this is just not have people start up on drugs. And I said, prevention is very much an important part of this calculus that we're talking about here. And yet it sounds a little like don't say no to drugs like Nancy Reagan said, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that DARE is one of the best evaluated programs for prevention. And the evaluations are very clear. It doesn't work. I mean, kids do not listen. They don't use drugs less. Now, on the other hand, there are good prevention programs that invest in kids and teach them about things like how to manage emotion, how to interact with other people, how to provide positive activities for them, cultural, civic, religious, educational, whatever it is. And those kinds of investments do pay off in reduced addiction. But it's just a lot more complicated raising kids, as any parent knows, than just saying, well, just say no. It's just not that simple.
I'm going to invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We're talking about combating California's opioid crisis. And the opioid crisis is a national crisis, to be sure. Many of you listening to us on Sirius or on the Internet, University of Virginia report said that deaths are severely underreported. They have figured about 24% higher in opioids and 22% in heroin. A lot of these deaths can be – it was a study, by the way, that just looked at pretty much four states, Arizona, Iowa, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. But there are ways to deal with overdose. There are, you know, things that can be done. And we're talking about some of the ways really – to combat this ongoing crisis. And you may want to weigh in, and we do want to hear from you if you have some thoughts, if you have some questions or some comments. Please feel free to join the program. Let me give you the toll-free number to do that. It's 866-733-6786. You can call us now. And again, we welcome your calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Number to call, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways that you can join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You can also go to our Facebook page, but we do invite your participation in the program. I remind you that Keith Humphries is with us. He's professor of psychiatry with the Stanford School of Medicine. Jennifer Kent is also with us this morning, director of the California Department of Healthcare Services, and Kelly Pfeiffer, who's here in studio, who directs the high-value care team with the California Healthcare Foundation. We're going to be talking with you, our listeners, and we're also going to be checking in with Katie Bell, who is program manager for medication-assisted treatment program at Chappaday, an Indian healthcare facility in Auburn and Grass Valley. Again, the problem is not only located in the rural areas now. It has become a problem throughout California and throughout the United States. Feel free to weigh in. We want to hear from you. Any questions or comments? You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the opioid crisis, not only here in California, but throughout the United States. And it is certainly affecting all too many lives and taking too many lives. Kelly Pfeiffer here in studio with us directs the high-value care team with the California Healthcare Foundation. And Jennifer Kent with us by phone is director of the California Department of Healthcare Services. And Keith Humphries is also with us. He's professor of psychiatry at the Stanford School of Medicine. Again, we welcome your involvement in the program, and we're going to indeed get to your calls and emails forthwith here. But we wanted to get Katie Bell on with us. She's program manager for medication-assisted treatment program at Chappaday, an Indian health care service in Auburn and Grass Valley. And Katie Bell, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I missed the previous callers and speakers, so I may repeat myself.
That's okay.
Thanks for having me. I'm getting ready to set up a group. But
well, yeah. I want to actually find out from you if you could maybe just give us a snapshot of what you're seeing up there in Auburn and Grass Valley and how extensive the problem is and what's being done about it.
Well, we have a very rocky, extensive wilderness and terrain, so distance is a big issue. And the other thing is, because we have not had all the resources that we needed, excuse me, to address the crisis, what I see is that there's been severe degradation of wellness in families and in lives. So what we call the bottom in recovery work language is much lower. Most of our patients not only have a severe heroin or opiate use disorder, but they also have felonies, are losing their children, don't have work, don't have cars, don't have homes. So because of the slow response in some ways to the problem, we are dealing with deeper social problems on top of the severity of the addictions.
It sounds almost like a plague. I'm sorry mm-hmm. to put it so.
Yeah.
And the real question at this point is, what can be done in terms of federal help that can ameliorate the problems?
Well, we have had some significant federal help with the HRSA grants that came in March of 2016, and so that has helped the primary care clinics develop medication-assisted treatment programs, which really basically is about providing buprenorphine medication and treatment at the same time. We've been very active in the development of that. And so doors are open now, but we need more help. We need more social services. We need more treatment beds. So the need is so big. Every time we step into our clinic, the work is big in terms of meeting the needs of the patients, bringing them in, stabilizing them, and supporting them, especially in the early phases of recovery.
I'm looking at a question here from a listener, which perhaps you can provide some light on, if you would, Katie Bell. It's a listener, and it's a question that's often asked, why the drug use is so rampant in the United States compared to other countries? And that's a big question, and I may go to Keith Humphreys with it, but why do you see such rampant drug use up there? I mean, how much of it has to do with economics or just overall sense of ennui and apathy and boredom and anger and all the rest of those emotions?
There are multiple factors. This thing really took off during the recession when people lost their jobs, lost their sense of stability, and but they're all, you know, the supply has been pretty significant with prescription pills and heroin. So I think there's multiple factors, but the economic issue is a big one. A sense of despair in the communities, and families kind of falling apart around the recession has been a big factor, too. People losing their homes, losing their jobs, and having opioids to cope with the emotional, psychic, and physical pain of all of this.
Yeah, no, it sounds devastating, and I'm aggrieved to hear what's going on up there, but it's going on throughout the country. Can you actually talk briefly before I let you go here about what you're doing with respect to medication-assisted treatment?
Well, I'm sure the others have talked about buprenorphine, naloxone, and it is a very effective treatment, stabilizes the addictive part of the brain and buys time for our patients to get the rest of their lives together. I've been working with it since before it was FDA approved. So it is a very effective beginning treatment. It is not the only treatment. If you just give the medication without the support and the care and the recovery process, patients will not do well. So we have a solution. Our real work is to change attitudes, to open doors, to, even in the primary care setting, to really change the culture so that we treat addiction as the chronic disease that it is, and to build that caring, supportive environment for them when they walk in to primary care, which is, it's a big shift for primary care. And working, we have, one of the things that we do up here in the mountains is we have local collaboratives where we all the stakeholders, the jail people, the law enforcement, the county, the providers of recovery, we get everybody at the table so that we get to know each other and we build strong bridges of care. It's kind of been a spontaneous thing, but very useful.
Well, Katie Bell, I thank you for joining us. And
all right. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate the work you're doing up there. Continue. Onward.
All right. Thank you so much.
Katie Bell, again, is Program Manager for Medication-Assisted Treatment Program at Chappaday Indian Health in Auburn and Grass Valley. Bonnie tweets to us, three things: treatment, treatment, treatment. The war on drugs is not scientifically backed. It is based on a new Jim Crow. Let me go. You can add your comments to this discussion again by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website kqed.org/forum. Let us go first to Louise in Redwood City. Louise, join us. Welcome.
Hi there. I am all for the treatment, the war against this. However, there are some people that, you know, like myself, who I had back surgery, spine surgery about a year ago, and then had a staph infection as a result of that. Two more spine surgeries right after that because of the staph infections. And as a result, had a very high tolerance for opiates, and have had to be on them for the past, you know, eight, nine months. And it's not ideal. I don't want to be, but the level of pain is such that I can't live a healthy, active life with my family or my kids. And I'm having a hard time actually getting access to the medication that I need because of, you know, some of the, you know, what's going on right now. And I absolutely understand it. However, you can't just cut somebody off who is in a situation like myself because of what's going on. And there are different companies right now that are, you know, using this as a way to cut costs and, you know, saying that they're only going to use 90 milligram, or I think it's like a 90 milligram per day for people. So you can only get access to a certain amount of medication. And so you've gone from whatever you're taking per day and they just drop you. And it cuts costs for them and for insurance companies. And as a result, people are left not having their medication and they go elsewhere.
All right, and I thank you for bringing up your own situation, and I'm sorry you're in all that pain, but you've raised an important point here. And Keith Humphries, what do we say to those who are having problems with access, like the caller?
No, it's a real problem all over the country. We have to hold two things in our head at the same time. On the one hand, at the aggregate level, we prescribe way too much opioids. We prescribe 6-8 times what other developed countries do. But in the level of individual patients, there's people who should be getting opioids who are not, because doctors are scared of – now they've kind of gone the other direction. Now they're scared every single person's going to be addicted. The truth is opioids are very valuable when they're used the right way. It's also true – let me just put in a plug for our terrific, you know, pain medicine program at Stanford. There are hundreds of other medications that can be used, and also non-medical things for pain that a lot of doctors don't know about, or they don't have the time to do. All they have time is to write a script.
We've got to do a program on some of the research in this area, because non-addictive substances that are being at least we're on some real new horizons here. I'm hopeful about that.
Yeah, and there's good reason to be hopeful. Some medication, also there's some psychotherapies that help people with pain. There's exercise that help people with pain. But, you know, that we have to deliver that to the country. We can't just say, you know, tell people to suffer. And you know, we're lucky at Stanford. We have a great pain medicine group. Again, if you go to a rural area, you don't have that resource typically, and we really need to get that out for people.
Let me thank the caller and bring another caller on. John wants to talk about Big Pharma and this, and certainly in my mind. John, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. a brief comment first. I think this is a timely topic, and I want to thank you for bringing it up. And I concur. Addiction steals lives. And for those of us who are familiar with it and have seen it up close, no one would choose addiction. No one would choose to live a life where you're seeking painkillers every day. That's just ridiculous to even conceive. And the previous caller notwithstanding, my compassion's to her as well. That's a dialogue between the doctor and the patient that just needs to take place. And for those that are articulate, as she has, I'm sure that she can make that appeal. My concern, however, is relevant to Big Pharma. It is hard for me, and I don't want to spur anxiety or conspiracy theories against Big Pharma. We need pharma. They do a great role, but it's hard for me to appreciate or understand fully when there it seems to be a little bit counterintuitive that it's against it's somehow, you know, to make the sales and get it out there, it seems to be working against controlling that. And I'm just wondering, how do we spur a dialogue where we bring Big Pharma into the big discussion and understand how we hold them? Because I can't fathom that they're not culpable in some way. And how do we bring them into the solution and into the dialogue going forward?
I think in terms of moving forward, it's a central and important question. Can I get you to opine, Keith Humphreys?
Yeah, well, we don't have to speculate that they're culpable because Purdue Pharma pled guilty in federal court
That's
to
right.
being culpable. Yeah, and they were fined over $500 million, which is only a small part of the money they got. So, yeah, Pharma has definitely contributed. I mean, they really seized the agenda, the good agenda that medicine sort of developed in the 90s of let's do a better job managing pain. And they kind of took that to, you know, took and ran with it to everybody should be on our product, our opioids. And there was deceptive marketing, and there's still many lawsuits going. Santa Clara County, in fact, is suing manufacturers over this. So they do need to be held accountable. You know, it may have to be something like the master settlement, you know, that happened with the tobacco industry, where an industry that's caused a lot of destruction needs to be held responsible by the political process to pay the enormous costs that they've imposed on everybody.
Let me go to a comment here and go to you on this, Jennifer Kent, if I may. Anne writes, can you comment about the lack of residential care facilities available to regular people? I've heard about a trend in Southern California where investors buy a house in a high-end, family-populated suburban area, fill it with people in recovery, and provide services. This is a money-making affair and totally unregulated. Jennifer Kent.
Sure. So, you know, we as a department license residential treatment facilities both for Medicaid services. Obviously, we're the Medicaid agency as well. But we also license these residential facilities that are not accepting Medicaid, so commercial insurance or private pay. And there is a segment of the industry that is known as sober living environments or sober living homes. Those are not licensed and they're not regulated. And so what you have seen is a lot of confusion in the consumer marketplace. You've seen a lot of unethical behaviors. And a lot of times people come to our department seeking for us to take action against those homes or those facilities. And if they're not licensed because they don't they're not subject to the regulation, that makes it really difficult. And again, it gets back to confusion in the marketplace. And so, you know, we take steps against providers that are providing treatment services, meeting licensure requirements. But sometimes if you're under six beds, the way federal housing and non-discrimination statutes lay out is it's perfectly reasonable to allow people up to six to live in a home that is otherwise decided to be sober. And that's where people start to stretch the gray area of whether you're offering services such as treatment and or whether you're just allowing people to live in a sober environment. And that's kind of the area that is currently unregulated.
Let me go to something else with you, follow up a bit on that, Jennifer Kent. I'd like to ask you about the treatment that works best and what the state is focusing on. Drug treatment is certainly hard. There are lots of relapses. What's the state priorities in terms of treatment services?
Ah, great question. So we have a couple of really kind of unique initiatives that we're working on here at the department. The first is what was mentioned earlier by Dr. Pfeiffer. We received a big federal grant for about $90 million over the next 2 years to create hub and spoke systems in California, you know, using very experienced narcotic treatment programs to work you know, and spoke their services out to primary care providers and clinics. And so that is a lot of money, and we hope a lot of good comes out of that, meaning we want providers in rural areas or providers that are not necessarily familiar or comfortable treating people with substance use disorders to become more comfortable, because we recognize that not everybody can go to a treatment facility or to a very high-level treatment provider. And so we're trying to build that familiarity and really broaden our bench in terms of provider strength. One of the other things that we're really excited about is this Medicaid waiver amendment that I referenced earlier that's setting up organized delivery systems in California. We have seven counties that are currently operational. They started back in February. Our last county, Los Angeles, went live in July, so last month. And the difference in services for these counties that we are working with is it's a full continuum of care for people with substance use disorder need, and not just opioids, but you know, alcohol or other types of drug dependencies, you know, including outpatient services, naltrexone treatment, medication-assisted treatment, residential services, withdrawal management, recovery services, case management, consultation, partial hospitalization. Those are all new services that Medicaid has not provided before in California. And so these counties that we're working with and more kind of coming on online will, I think, be a model for the rest of the country for how we work with Medicaid populations and help them not only get treated for their addiction, but also if they relapse, that we have services and supports in place to ease them back into sobriety.
Again, Jennifer Kent directs the California Department of Healthcare Services. It all sounds pretty promising, Kelly Pfeiffer, but what's going to happen? I mean, maybe you can give us a picture if these Medicaid cuts go through the way we're looking at.
Oh, I had about a week where I was relaxing that we might be able to preserve the Affordable Care Act as it is. But I do think that we have to fight to try and maintain Medicaid at the current levels, because California is underfunded. The amount that we spend on per capita from Medicaid is one of the lowest of all the states. So certainly if we get cuts, we will have to be flexible and adapt and think about new ways of delivering services. An example is telemedicine, and to supplement the work that the Health Services Department is doing, we're trying to look at areas of the state that don't have access and how you can get live video counseling and live video medication management direct to a person's phone. There's another innovative business model we're working with where we take a doc who's got a primary care practice, and that person gets paid 6 hours a month to do medication management while all the other buprenorphine management and group counseling is done by an addiction counselor. We're just trying to be very creative about how to reach these areas that don't have narcotic treatment programs and how to get the medications to the people.
You have to be creative. You have to think out of the box constantly, huh? Let me bring some more callers. And again, Kelly Pfeiffer directs the high-value care team with the California Healthcare Foundation. Let's go to Roger. Roger, thanks for waiting.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, I own a house in Montgomery County, Ohio, where we have the highest amount of opioid overdoses. And I just want to say, you know, how much it just devastates, you know, the community. Not only the, just the crime, like I've had people come and steal the aluminum siding off of my house, the hinges off of my gates, anything and everything they can possibly get to just get, you know, enough money for another fix. You know, condoms in the alleys. You know, I got to always search for the needles. And, you know, it's just it's a horrible situation. You know, we have actually a lot of money coming into the county for infrastructure, and people can't qualify for the job because they can't pass the drug test, or they have, you know, this horrific arrest record. And it just looks like a complete stalemate where, you know, you have people that are going to be stuck in this cycle of recovery and then no options once they get out of recovery, so they end up back in crime, selling drugs, making very little money, but, you know, getting addicted again and, you know, no place to go, no place out. And I really would suggest, you know, putting in a program where people can expunge a lot of their arrest record that's related to drug offenses so that they can at least start their life over when they get clean.
I thank you, Roger, for that picture, grim as it is, that you've provided, as well as the suggestion and recommendation. Appreciate hearing from you, and let's hear from another caller, and that's Philip. Philip, join us. You're on the air.
Yes. I heard that in Florida, I believe it was. I heard a program in there. Health professionals and people from pharmacy actually get people re-addicted because they run out of the treatment sessions they're allotted by their state governments. So what can be done about these unethical people or even criminal people that are doing this, re-addicting the addicts? And one other thing I wanted to know, why can't states raise their allotments for this treatment? Why do we always depend upon the federal government for everything? Why can't we, in our budgets, appropriate money for treatment of these things?
Thank you for those questions. Let me go first to this notion of re-addiction. Keith Humphreys, how widespread do we know that this is indeed as widespread as this has been the caller suggesting?
I don't know the specific case that the caller is referring to, but you know, one of the things law enforcement is good for is on the supply side. So it's, you know, we shouldn't be throwing addicted people who do petty criminals into prison. But, you know, there are still pill mills that are, you know, ruthless profit-making enterprises that certainly addict many people and also re-addict many people. And Florida, in fact, has the most. And that's where law enforcement's useful in closing those things down. On the other point about the states increasing funding, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I suspect California is doing that. But that's hard to do for a lot of these states. You know, my home state, West Virginia, we're classy people, but we aren't rich. You know, Arkansas, Tennessee, a lot of them don't have the resources to do that, and that's why the federal government is really important.
Looking at a comment from Noel who says, chronic pain patients need opiates. Then there are people addicted due to poverty and lack of opportunity. It's more than a public health problem. It's an indictment of our overall society. Just say no has no understanding of the complexity of the problem. And Vincent tweets, a 50-year American cycle of heroin, coke, crack, meth, and now opioids. Why not reduce the number of addicted-prone people? Let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Jason. Jason, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks, Michael. So I work in the treatment field, and I have a national perspective on this, and want to echo Dr. Pfeiffer's comments that California has really been a leader in using innovative models, and Dr. Pfeiffer referenced the hub-and-spoke model that California is developing across the state, which is really a fantastic model for expanding access, creating more access points, and it's just one of the ways in which California is leading the nation. But there's also a significant concern about the Affordable Care Act and the expansion population that has been able to use Medicaid to access treatment, which has been really, really important. Lots of people have been able to come into treatment as a result of the expansion. Unfortunately, some congressional representatives here in California, including Valadeo and McCarthy from the Central Valley, have been working to undermine the Affordable Care Act or repeal it, and that will be a huge problem even for constituents within their own neighborhoods. So I want to say that as we talk about declaring a federal emergency, what's really important is that more important than declaring a federal emergency would be preserving the Affordable Care Act. And lastly, I just want to comment briefly on the last caller who commented about re-addicting people. I want to make sure everybody understands that opiate use disorder is a chronic relapsing disease. It's a brain disorder. It's not a lack of willpower or moral downfall. And when people are addicted, they generally aren't cured and then re-addicted. They are, you know, going through the normal cycle that we expect of relapse and recovery. And it's important for everyone to understand that because it's not a lack of willpower or moral downfall, and it requires a public health response rather than a criminal justice response, I think.
Okay, Jason, I appreciate the points you make, and I thank you for the call. And I'm going to read another remark here from a listener who says, this is all about incentives. The healthcare industry is profit-driven. Big Pharma develops great drugs but are driven by incentives to sell more, for doctors to prescribe more. Healthcare is designed to generate profit. Good outcomes are a desirable byproduct. And here's Navit. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm a pharmacist here in California. I just want to share a perspective of a pharmacist, and I believe that I represent most of my colleagues on the issue. For a pharmacist, it's not very easy to turn away a patient with a prescription for pain medication. One of the patients was saying that whoever needs pain medication should not be turned away. But the problem here is that it is very difficult to, for us being responsible for under the corresponding responsibility rule to judge that what is important and what is not important. The reason is that all these prescriptions come like any other prescription. I think there is a need to have a conduit developed between a prescriber and the pharmacy and other providers whereby these prescriptions come with a little bit more information so that every person involved in the chain has some kind of information to decide whether it is something that should be dispensed without any problem, or that should be looked upon a little bit more deeper.
All right. Navid, I thank you, and I thank all of you who called in with suggestions and recommendations, and I thank our guests. Appreciate Kelly Pfeiffer, your being with us this morning. Thank you. Kelly Pfeiffer, again, directs high-value care team with the California Healthcare Foundation. And thanks to Jennifer Kent, who is with us by phone from Sacramento, who directs the California Department of Healthcare Services. Thank you, Jennifer Kent.
Thank you.
And thank you, Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine.
Thanks, Michael.
And thank you again, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We've got another hour up ahead. We're going to shift gears. We're going to have David Perlman with us, science writer for many, many years with the San Francisco Chronicle. And we're also going to talk to Marcus Garley, who has a play at Cal Shakes in Orinda. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Devin Holt. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer today is Katie McMurrin. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald, and our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for listening, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.